The following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
Now, you understand the conditions of your parole.
I gotta get along with you, or you're gonna send me back to jail.
Dustin Hoffman.
You're on parole?
I figure I served my time, and I just earned a little bit of freedom.
My friend, I see that you're gonna force me to deal with you.
Straight tie.
All I want to do is get a job.
Damn, job.
Dustin Hoffman.
Well, it's like a dream, you know. It's every con's fantasy to be out here. I can't tell you the number of times I thought about a scene just like this.
Straight time.
You can't trust me. I mean, what the hell? I'm just wasting gas, right?
I don't want you to waste your gas.
You're
gonna kill us, man.
Dustin Hoffman. Straight time. Dustin Hoffman.
You're harboring a fugitive.
Take my chances.
I mean, a cop could knock on that door, put you in jail.
Straight time. Dustin Hoffman.
Wait a minute, what are you doing?
You step back, please.
Straight time. It's the time it takes for a man to lose or win.
Welcome to The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me this week is author Andy Rausch.
Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. I'm a big fan of the show.
This week we're talking about Straight Time from director Ulu Grosbard. This 1978 film is based on the book No Beast So Fierce by Edward Bunker. It stars Dustin Hoffman as Max Denbo, a convict who's out on parole and, despite his better efforts, goes back to a life of crime. Along for the ride are Teresa Russell as his girlfriend, Gary Busey as an old friend, Kathy Bates, a surprisingly skinny Kathy Bates, as Busey's wife, and Harry Dean Stanton as Max's partner. But for me, the real star of the show is M. Emmett Walsh as Earl Frank, Max's parole officer. At the moment, I'm a little ambivalent about this film, so tell me, Andy, what appeals to you about Straight Time?
Well, I think that it's a really underrated film in that it's got one of the greatest performances by Dustin Hoffman in a decade in which he ruled. You know, he was great in the 70s. The 70s were a great decade for crime films, and I feel like this is a very gritty little film. The dialogue is gritty because it was written, you know, by a con, so it has an air of authenticity. The locations are very seedy, very realistic. But again, the performances are what moved me the most about this film. I think the performances are spectacular from top to bottom. You know, I'm also very intrigued by character motivations in this film. I don't always necessarily understand the characters' motivations. I really look at this film as being sort of a con's fantasy, an idealized look at the way things might look on the outside. You know, because even though a lot of the little scenarios are very realistic, the day-to-day life of a con, I feel like there are some really unrealistic scenarios. You know, Hoffman's relationship with Teresa Russell, you know, he meets her immediately and she's down for whatever. She goes right along with all of his bullshit. And, you know, that seems a little bit fantastical. But I've really always loved this film, and I just find it to be very, very fascinating.
It is an interesting film. I don't know if it's entirely successful. I love the casting. It's really nice to see just so many people who... Well, hell, there's still, you know, actively working today. I mean, you've got Kathy Bates on TV now and Busey all over the place. Jake Busey playing, I know this is a stretch, but playing Gary Busey's son in the film. And yeah, it was a really good time for Hoffman. I mean, I'm a huge fan of things like Little Big Man and some other of his 70s work. So it's tough seeing him as a tough guy. It's really hard to buy. Dustin Hoffman as a tough guy. I'm not sure. Maybe it's just because of his stature, or I know that he's got the long hair going and the mustache and everything, but it's still really tough to even buy him when he's just being that kind of like cold, giving off that killer stare and that kind of thing. I know he was really trying hard to make that happen. Did a lot of work with Eddie Bunker, met Eddie Bunker while Bunker was still in prison, really helped him out. It worked with him on the set. I mean, that was part of the agreement when they made the film, was that Bunker had to be around to give the film this whole air of authenticity. But yeah, just the thing that should have been the most authentic was Hoffman as this con, and I didn't necessarily buy that.
Well, it's funny. I think I can buy some of it more than you can simply through the performance. However, when I look at him, I don't get the stature. You know, I don't get the idea that he's this prison superstar that Edward Bunker described, you know, because he described that he would be a superstar in prison, but when he got out, he would be nothing more than, you know, like an extra. I mean, he doesn't look the role of tough guy, and I'll give you that, but there was a lot in the performance, particularly in the eyes. The part where Busey, you know, does the drugs in his apartment, Hoffman looks at him and gives him that cold stare and says, I could do 3 years just for you doing that, you know. And it's just something in the delivery that just seems, I buy it. I just buy it. Maybe it's those pork chop sideburns. I don't know.
When doing research on this, I kind of like over-immersed myself in this work a little bit. I read the book, I found the screenplay, read the screenplay, and then I watched the movie. And when it came to the movie, there's on the DVD anyway, there's like the making of featurette, director's commentary. Well, it's a co-commentary between Grossbard and Hoffman. Doesn't sound like they were in the same room by any stretch. In fact, it sounds like they had some difficulties while they were on the set. I don't know if they're still pals or not, but definitely sounds like they recorded those in two different times. But it was fascinating to see how this project went and how it changed and how it evolved. You know, reading No Beast So Fierce and seeing how that was. And I like what you said about Bunker really being the star in prison and then going out into the real world and being an extra. That really does fit well. And I think, I can't remember if that was what he said or if you're just having this moment of brilliance with that. But it was an interesting book. I really, at first, I was having a hard time getting through it. It's a little bit pretentious from the title right on down. I mean, with the Richard III quote as the title of it. And just, it feels a little bit overwritten. As it goes along, I kind of get used to his prose style a little bit more, but it feels like he was sitting there kind of like with a thesaurus and like kind of doing something that I tend to do sometimes. Like, I can't really use the same word more than once, so I want to use a different word. But he was going for like the $10 words when maybe he should have stuck more to like the 50 cents words. He kind of got over that as the book went along a little bit. Either that or I got used to it as we were going along. Getting through like the first 100 pages was like, it was a slog. And what I really liked was the whole thing about him and his parole officer. As I mentioned before, in the book, that relationship is really kind of built out a little bit more. And just how his parole officer has no idea what it's like to be a convict, though he does enjoy this position of power and really kind of abuses this position of power. One of the things that just really briefly touch on in the movie that they don't really go into a whole lot is, as you were talking about that scene with Busey where he shoots up in Max's hotel room, and then Emma Walsh comes in and sees the matches and has Dustin Hoffman arrested, gets him drug tested, thrown back in jail, and he's in jail. They don't really explain this too well, but in the book they talk about how he's in jail for like over a week. And when Emma Walsh comes in and is talking to him, he's like, oh yeah, sorry, I got real busy and I was out on vacation. And he's like letting Dustin Hoffman's character, just, you know, the Max Dembo character, rot in jail for a week when he should have gotten him out like a day later when the drug test came back and said that he hadn't been doing heroin. But no, you know, sorry, got real busy. You know, that's not a problem, right? Like, super passive aggressive.
You know, it works on several levels. They even throw in, you know, a couple of racist comments to let us know that, you know, he's kind of a dick.
So how you doing?
I think I'm doing slam down.
What?
I'm okay.
Yeah, listen, your urine tested clean. I'm sorry you got stuck here, but you know, I had my hands full this week. This is the first chance I had to get back to you.
Did the phones break down?
Don't get sarcastic with me, Dembo. Now, I'm having you released from here. I'm going to take you to a halfway house myself.
When is that? Now?
Right now. I think that's more than generous.
You're the boss.
Right. And you're smart enough to recognize a break when you get one. I mean, you were clean, but somebody fixed in your room. And that's a violation of your parole, and it's good enough to get you a minimum of 2 to 3 years. Am I right? So we'll start from scratch.
Sure.
We'll get you cleaned up, and we'll get you out of here.
The movie was originally adapted by Alvin Sargent, and the screenplay is huge. I mean, they talk about in the director's commentary that the original screenplay was something like 180 pages, you know, 3 hours long. It's like, I don't know why screenwriters are even writing films that are 3 hours long. I mean, even especially in the 70s, I mean, you don't have a whole lot of 3 hour films going on. I mean, I'm sure with your cinematic knowledge, you're going to think of like five right off the top of your head that are three hours long, but something small, low budget like this, that's 3 hours. This isn't a Godfather two, but yeah. And then apparently they took that screenplay and cut it down to 120 minutes, which I think works a little bit better. And it really does for me capture the No Be So Fierce novel pretty well. Though, of course, you're missing a lot of that internal dialogue. So you are missing a lot of the character motivations. And you had mentioned in the intro that, you know, you're not really seeing why people are doing a lot of things that they're doing. And unfortunately, I think that's really kind of missing from the film as you go from one medium to another.
They use the script as the framework of the film, but they did a lot of improvisation. And I find it fascinating that in a lot of places, this Cassavetes-like improvisation is a lot better than what's on the written page by Alvin Sargent. I mean, there's a discussion about smog being like farts, you know, which is very uneloquent. I can't imagine that appearing in the film. And, you know, I just feel like a lot of the dialogue that appears in the film really, really works in a way that the dialogue in the script just sort of falls flat.
It was good that they improvised. And we should probably also say that originally Grossbard had nothing to do with this project. Grossbard was an old friend of Hoffman's, and he had directed him before in some previous work on stage and on screen. But originally this was going to be Hoffman's directorial debut. The audio commentary to me was really interesting to hear Hoffman saying that, you know, he was going to do this, and, you know, he gives this whole scenario about going out to San Quentin. And
the reason I wanted to go up and do it ahead of production was because there was, it was one of the prisons I had gone to that, and Eddie had shown it to me. He said, this, hey man, he was certainly an authority. He was a location manager as well as anything else. And it's built like a, like, you know, Gothic has a look to it. And if you go in the winter, he says there's a ring around it that's really bizarre. It's a ring of fog, like almost a halo right off the ground. And he says it just gives it this mysterious, you know, unworldly look that visually would be wonderful as a metaphor. And we went up to Folsom. And first we went up and we saw that ring of fog, and we started shooting, or we're going to start shooting. And we all arrived in the morning and there's no fog. And that was my introduction to filmmaking, which is, what do you do? And this is, of course, before special effects or even playback, you know. And one guy is telling me, wait. You know, and the other guy's telling me, I mean, an editor and a DP is, you know, one's telling me, wait for the fog, just don't shoot today. You know, but the studio wants it, don't do it, man. If you do it, then they've got you. They'll make you shoot every day. The fog, and we wait. And I think we waited like 3 or 4 days with a crew up there paying them, waiting for that magic to happen, and it didn't. And, you know, one principal crew person is telling me to shoot, the other one's telling me to wait. So finally, we said, we're not going to get it. In retrospect, I'm sorry that I didn't direct it. I think I just lacked the courage because, again, we didn't have playback. So I was asking the DP and I was asking the editor and I was asking, you know, the production, each of them. I would say, so how was that take? And one would say it was wonderful. The other one said it was not. You should do it again. And I couldn't watch. If I had had playback, I'm convinced I would have just directed it.
you know, kind of going back to your improvisational thing, it sounds like he was bouncing off of so many other people that he didn't have that internal drive to say, fuck it, I'm going to shoot this thing right now, let's go. You know, and you need that, like, kind of Cassavetes head honcho there in that kind of spirit to say, like, I'm going to do this no matter what it takes. And he was so used to, it sounds like to me anyway, being this kind of collaborator that he didn't have that drive to just say, I'm going to do this the way that I want. And he just kept second guessing himself the whole damn time. So he knew that he was doomed. You know, after that, he was just like, there's no way I can do this. I mean, but he had done so many things right up to that point where he had done a lot of the casting. He had got the script approved. He had gotten the money in place, of course, which we know is the most important thing. And then when he realized that he couldn't shoot it, he went out and he was smart enough to say, I can't do this. I need help. And he got Grossberg to come in and help him out.
Well, and I find it fascinating that he found directing to be so daunting that he didn't, try to make another film until right now. He's got a film called Quartet that I believe is in post-production. It will be his directorial debut officially. And, it took, 33 years.
Yeah, well, Quartet, which I hear is a prequel to Quintet, so that should be very interesting.
Really?
No, I'm just kidding. But wouldn't it be neat to have a sequel to Robert Altman's Quintet?
Right, right.
It was so funny to hear him talk about that. I mean, the audio commentary to me was actually kind of hilarious because you've got Hoffman constantly second-guessing himself about the directing stuff, and then you've got him just, like, super nervous about getting ass-f***ed in prison.
Right.
It just kept coming up and coming up, like, Eddie, I'm going to be the guy that goes in here and gets sodomized. You know, what could I have done to, if I went to prison to not be sodomized? You know, it comes up so many times, or at least it feels like it to me. He probably mentions it once, but it just made such an impact on me. But it was just like, man, Dustin, you've got some good fears going on here. And just like how he talks about how he could have been the guy that went to prison. And he's got a lot of guilt going on. So, I mean, I guess it that whole thing of like damaged people making really good actors might apply to Hoffman in this case.
I found it fascinating how much he looked at Eddie Bunker also, not only for inspiration, but for a lot of times, direct guidance. What would you do here? What would you do there? If I'm going to go into Gary Busey's house to shoot him, how would I go in? Would I go through the front door? Would I, and I found it interesting. You talked about him needing that collaboration, and it looks like he definitely found that sort of collaboration and inspiration in Edward Bunker.
Yeah, exactly. Now, it was funny to me, we kind of glossed over the title change. They changed it from No Beast So Fierce, which Grossbard rightfully thought no one would get the reference or, would just not really sell a film. At this time, we've got so many wild animals and crazy insect movies going on that people probably thought it was going to be like a killer bear story or something. They went with the title Straight Time, which apparently is, at least according to his definition, I have never been to prison so far anyway, so I'm not really sure if this is correct or not. But to him, it was that you've done your time, you have a sentence, you do your time, and then you get to go out and there is no parole. And so it was kind of a weird choice then, if that's the case, that they use that as the title, because parole is so much a part of this story and it really kicks things off so much. And going back to your point earlier about not really buying some of the stuff that happens in the movie and this being kind of more of a Khan's fantasy, it was really weird to me that there was no pursuit of Hoffman at all after he breaks parole. It's such a great scene when he breaks parole, but after he does in the movie and the screenplay, everything, whatever, he's out, no worries. There's a little bit of worry in the book, but in the movie, it's just like, he goes to Teresa Russell's house and he's just like, hey, you're harboring a known fugitive. And that's it. And then, that pretty much turns her on. She's like, let's go to bed, baby.
Edward Bunker was apparently so in love with this quotation from Richard III that he also inserts it at the end of the film Runaway Train, which he co-wrote. The film ends with a black screen and the line, no beast so fierce, but knows some touch of pity, but I know none and therefore am no beast. So he was so in love with that apparently he was going to try that in basically every project he did until it stuck.
It's kind of like the Ezekiel 25:17 speech from Tarantino that shows up constantly. Yeah. So we should say, too, that folks that aren't familiar with Bunker might be more familiar with him than they know, because, yeah, he did co-write the screenplay for Runaway Train. He has a small role in it. He's got a small role in Straight Time. And then he's got a small role, unfortunately, and I wish he had more, in Reservoir Dogs. He's Mr. Blue, who you pretty much just see at the beginning, and then that's it. He never really shows up again.
And Tarantino has said that Straight Time was a bit of an inspiration for Reservoir Dogs, in the fact that you've got these blue-collar, you know, work-a-day thieves, you know, that they're just basically going to work, that's their job, they're not mob guys, they're just thieves.
Yeah, and then you've got the jewelry heist at the end and everything, and I did like that they had the different heists and stuff, but I will say that the robbery of the pawn shop in the book is a little bit more built out than it is in the movie, because you really get like him kind of casing out this whole joint and going back into this pawn shop, and it's next to, I think, a barber shop, and he figures that these are just plaster walls and that he can break through, and there's really a lot more tension there. But again, I think that's all because of that internal, you know, like him pausing and hearing the people that are laughing from the club that's outside and all this kind of stuff. So it's a shame that they didn't capture more of that. And it's also a shame that I can't really say, well, go read the book, because the book is so much better, because it's better in a lot of aspects, but it's not 100% better. There are things that they actually capture better on screen than they do in the book. So, and I kind of like the tightening up of a few things that they did. I like the elimination of a few of the characters, like the woman at the job board is Teresa Russell in the movie. She's a different character completely in the book, you know, and he meets Teresa Russell's character just a little bit later on. And, you know, so it made more sense to combine those two characters and all these things. But the one character who I really miss there, he has a friend in prison, this black guy, and Bunker really wrote a lot about prison relationships and sexual as well as non-sexual, but he really talked a lot about race relations in prison and just how they really were, you know, just coming to a head in the 70s, because, you know, you've got all of these movements going on outside filtering into this totally intense microcosm of society. But I love that he's got this black friend in the joint, can't really talk to him all the time because of the way that the tensions are in prison. But then he eventually, like, you know, he gets out and he checks in with the guy's mother, and the guy's mother says, oh, well, you know, he's up at this camp. So he has this whole system set up where he sends a postcard to the guy at camp, pretending to be the guy's mother, and then breaks him out. And then he becomes this third wheel as part of the gang. And I thought that was really kind of good, the way that they did that. And then, of course, there's a little bit of tension between he and who would be the Harry Dean Stanton character. Not a whole lot, which is a little, again, kind of the Khan's fantasy, you know, but hey, it's his book. He can do what he wants to do with it, right?
The thing that I'm always fascinated about is how bad of a criminal that Dustin Hoffman is. You know, you get this feeling that subconsciously he wants to get caught. You know, he basically tells Teresa Russell at one point that a lot of cons aren't comfortable on the outside, and we don't realize until later on, you know, how much he's talking about himself. But he's got to be one of the sloppiest criminals I've ever seen in my life. He delays the robberies. He does it not once, but twice, and basically gets his friend killed. They rob both the bank and the jewelry store with no masks, even though there's a great big camera visible right behind him. He wants to pull the card game robbery with just the pistol with the bullets falling out of it. You know, he pulls the jewelry heist with a driver with no experience. I mean, he's just a horrible criminal, and you get the feeling from the beginning that, you know, even though he's trying to go straight, that subconsciously he's ready to go back.
You know, that's a really good point, and that's something that I think that they capture a lot better in the movie than they do in the book, because in the book he doesn't make those mistakes, and he really pays attention to cameras, and they have masks and all these kind of things. And his driver does have experience. And it was, again, that's kind of a nice little way that they go back to the book and pull something out that should have been pulled out a little bit more, is the Gary Busey character. Max Dembo does not necessarily trust that character so much, because there was a past robbery where he left him high and dry. He was the driver in that case, and he left him high and dry. They don't use that character as the driver in the jewelry heist in the book, but then they go ahead, you know, because the black character is missing in the movie, they go ahead and they bring Gary Busey there, and that's when he proves that he's unreliable. So I thought that was a really nice way that they kind of condensed that and made that a little bit tighter, and also kind of brought to the fore that whole thing that you're talking about him being just one of the sloppiest criminals ever. Because also in the book, he gets away with stuff. You know, he manages to get away, and he kind of does in the movie a little bit, but you see at the end this whole series of mugshots kind of indicate that he's back in prison. But in the end of the book, it's him getting away. He goes, I believe, over to Spain, hangs out over there for a while. But then this last paragraph is like that he's running out of money and he's going to go ahead and go back to the United States and basically start his life of crime over again. And I think the last two words of the book are, "F*** it." He is going to go back to prison no matter what. So, but yeah, I thought that they did that really well in the movie, that they said, okay, yeah, this guy, I think on this subconscious level, is not comfortable in this real world, and that he is much more comfortable being the star of jail than being the extra on the outside world.
Well, you know, one of the things that I find fascinating is that Bunker himself was not a very good criminal. He had been in jail since the age of 13 or 14. You know, he was the youngest man ever in San Quentin. He had been convicted of things from bank robbery to drug dealing to armed robbery to forgery, and apparently got arrested for the bank robbery on his way to the bank robbery. Now, I don't know what he did to get arrested or, you know, how he tipped him off, but, you know, that was something that Ulu Grosbard talked about in that commentary. From his perspective, you know, these jobs might have worked because he's apparently a criminal who doesn't know the difference between a good score or a f***ed up flawed plan. And, you know, in that respect, he's just like the character. Even when he got his second chance in life and he got out of prison to work on this film, you know, they talk about how he was stoned on methadone all the time. He was late for everything by multiple hours.
Yeah, I think that he got arrested going to the bank robbery because they were trailing him for, like, drug possession or something. He had, like, narcs on his tail, and then he goes and he tries to do a bank robbery or something like that. It was absolutely ridiculous, like this comedy of errors. But then, yeah, it's funny, too, because I remember in the intro to the book, they were talking that at one point in his life, he was making a little bit of money by being the guy who would, like, come up with plans and then sell the plans to different criminals and be like, you know, oh, here's a really good idea. And it's like, man, I wonder if they had, like, a money-back guarantee with some of those or not.
Right, right.
I don't think that an Eddie Bunker plan necessarily would have been the best thing in the world to invest my money into.
Right, and that's basically the character he plays in the film. And I've got to say, he's got that horrible, horrible, obvious hairpiece. I wouldn't trust the guy's plan just based on the fact that he had that hairpiece, let alone, you know, how awful these plans apparently were.
Yeah, that was really bad. And then it was weird, they introduced that one character, the Latino guy, and he just kind of never comes back at all. It's just like, hey, remember this dude? You know, yeah, yeah. And I'm thinking, okay,
Eddie Bunker,
use this
you know,
guy later.
Tells
no.
him about a guy that would be great for him, you know, to be a driver. And instead, Dustin Hoffman says, knowing nothing about this guy that he just sees in the bar, he goes, who's that guy? He'd rather have that guy than the guy that Eddie Bunker is actually referring to him. And I find that fascinating as well. It's weird, and the motivation's not really described, you know, or explained, you know, what it is about this guy. Maybe he just looks like the guy that turns out to be his older brother that, you know, he used to hang out with. But, you know, I always found that weird. He's just like, well, who's this guy at random?
No interest in what is going on. And he should be paying a little bit more attention in trying to actually make these successful scores. But, yeah, he just to your earlier point, too, about him, you know, in the bank, and Harry Dean Stanton's just like, come on, man, you know, they're working on a tight time schedule, and they know that if they hit a bank within, you know, X number of minutes, that they're going to be okay and get away without the cops chasing them. But no, sure enough, he's just like, you know, oh, I could have got more money. I could have got more money. And Harry Dean's just yelling at him like, you know.
Man, from now on, when I say go, though, man, we got to go, man. When I yell go, clock. Go. You got clock. The clock, my ass, man. We always go through this shit.
I'm going to dock you $8,000, man. $8,000 you stopped me from getting from that last cover. $8,000 like, fucking dollars you
pulling
stopped
teeth
me.
To get you out of the fucking place.
It's all over the floor.
And then sure enough, same freaking thing happens later on. I mean, I can kind of understand that he's going, you know, looking for that watch that Teresa Russell expressed some interest in, but Yeah, it was just completely inexcusable for me. And it's like, you deserve to get caught, buddy. You know, you're really kind of a dumb criminal on this one. So I wish he were smarter, because I could have pulled for him a lot more.
Well, I also find it strange that he basically does the exact same thing twice. I mean, even if he'd have just delayed a moment the first time, so we kind of got a glimpse of it, but it seems to be the exact same thing in both robberies. And I found that unusual that, you know, they completely duplicated the second time. It's not just foreshadowing, but it's the same fucking thing.
One thing that didn't ring true in the audio commentary, I mean, you talked about how they improvised a lot of scenes, and that made sense to me, and I could see a lot of that, see a lot of differences between the screenplay and the finished film. But in the audio commentary, they were talking about how they were doing this assembly edit of everything that they had, and I guess that's where Grossbard and Hoffman really had their falling apart, was during this editing process. But they wanted to have this assembly edit to see what they have so that they could come up with the end of it. And that doesn't necessarily ring true to me, because the end of the book, the end of the screenplay, and the end of the movie all kind of fit together. And especially between the end of the screenplay and the end of the movie, there are so many similarities that I'm just like, well, it really doesn't feel like you guys improv the ending too much. So I don't know why you were saying that you had to do this assembly edit to see what you have so that you could end it in a proper way.
I also find it fascinating that Michael Mann and Jeffrey Boehm also worked as screenwriters on this project at different points. They don't talk on the commentary at all about their contributions, and apparently Alvin Sargent was the very first screenwriter, and the script that they went with, at least for framework, was Alvin Sargent. So, you know, I'll always be kind of curious, you know, what Michael Mann and Jeffrey Boehm's contributions to the project were.
Yeah, and apparently Nancy Dowd had worked on it a little bit as well. No mention of her whatsoever. I mean, they really just kind of glanced through the production of this, in that Boehm and Mann are two really, I mean, Boehm, I have some problems with some of the scripts that he's written. Same thing with Mann, but just they're very strong screenwriters. I mean, they do know their craft. So ignoring what they had to say, I would be very curious to see what their contributions were, where they would have taken this story. And especially, I mean, there were so many scenes in here that, I mean, they're definitely not shot like Michael Mann would shoot them. The scenarios themselves feel a little Michael Mann. I mean, these kind of, you know, daring daytime robbery things. I mean, of course, they're not there with, you know, it's not Heat. They're not out there with their machine guns and stuff. But yeah, it definitely would have fit with his milieu.
Right, I agree.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and take a break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Andy a little bit more about some of his own writing and some of his crime novels.
After movie diner promo, take one.
John Wayne here from the Brannigan Podcast. Has anyone seen the full version?
No, try again.
Sweaty Vernon here from the...
No, come on.
Hey, how's it going? I'm Matt Ringler from the Schlock Treatment Podcast. Hoping you'll tune in to After Movie Diner. It's my favorite podcast.
Better, but also at the same time completely useless. Try and mention the movie reviews, the interviews with independent film directors, things like that.
Matt Ringler from the Schlock Treatment Podcast here. Hoping you'll turn in for a...
It's tune in.
Matt Ringler from the Schlock Treatment Podcast. Hoping you'll turn it. Keep saying turn it.
How hard is it just to plank a damn show? Do it right, or I'm going to come down there and nail your face to the fridge.
Listen up, folks. Matt Ringler here from Schlock Treatment. I want to tell you about a great podcast, The After Movie Diner. There's plenty of pie, and everything's delicious, especially the host, the Sweaty Vernon.
No. I mean, he didn't even mention that the podcast is available every Monday at amdpodcast.blogspot.com and iTunes. Idiot.
Ahoy, mateys. This is KAB, Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous. 1340. KAB.
And now, a word from our sponsor. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
GGTMC live for you, fresh yeah. Big Willie and the Samurai are at your service, breaking films down and turning them around, giving recommendations that are always on point. Visit ggtmc.com for more information. The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. Bringing class to the trash since 1977.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at AdamandEve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out AdamandEve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at AdamandEve.com.
All right, welcome back to the Projection Booth. The reason why I invited this week's co-host Andy Roush onto the show is the natural. I mean, after all, he's spent half of his life in prison. Kidding. It was actually a natch because Andy's a huge fan of movies, especially the films of the 70s, which I also love, of course. And also, this year, Andy's got a new book out, a crime novel called The Suicide Game, which I've had the pleasure of reading. And in spite of all that, I'm going to go ahead and ask you to sum up the book for the listeners.
Well, it's kind of an interesting story. It's difficult to describe because it's very different than any other novel that I've read. It's much more similar, again, to films like Crash or Shortcuts or, Pulp Fiction would be the obvious. It's about different people's lives that intersect. And, you know, each of these people are very different, and they involve a gay phone sex operator, a black hitman who doubles as a UCLA professor, a newlywed, a murderous priest, a spoiled rich kid, a mob boss, a would-be movie writer, and a popular movie director. It's basically how all of their stories intersect in the streets of Los Angeles.
You're right. It does feel a little Pulp Fiction-y. I could definitely see that. I haven't seen Crash other than the David Cronenberg film. But I could definitely see where you're coming from with that. So, yeah, I got to ask you about this. You've written a ton of books. Can you just give me a little bit of a rundown of your nonfiction stuff for folks so they can hear what kind of things you've done?
Well, I've written 15 nonfiction books, working on a 16th now. And those include a book on the films of Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro, which focuses on their collaborations. With Chris Watson and David Walker, I wrote a book on black exploitation films of the 1970s. With the late cinematographer Gary Graver, I wrote a book on his collaborations with Orson Welles. I also wrote a book that's been used as a textbook in collegiate film courses called Turning Points in Film History. And other subjects I've covered include hip-hop music and Stephen King. The book that I'm working on now is a book with Herschel Gordon Lewis, the schlock filmmaker, and it's basically something like Scorsese on Scorsese, but with Herschel Gordon Lewis instead of Scorsese, so which is obviously quite a bit different. But
so it'll be Herschel Gordon Lewis on Scorsese, or Scorsese on Herschel Gordon Lewis?
That might be even more interesting.
Now, The Suicide Game was your first foray into fiction. Why did you decide to take the plunge?
Well, I'd thought about it for a long time, and I'd written several short stories, and then a friend of mine, Stephen Spignazzi, who had written a lot of books, nonfiction books, a lot. He's known for his books on Stephen King, and he's written about everything under the sun, basically. And he wrote a novel a few years ago called Dialogues. He sent a copy of it to me, and I received it, and I read it, and it was so amazing. And I thought, here's a guy that I know, and he's a normal guy, You know, he's somebody that seemed tangible to me because I knew him. And he was capable of writing this amazing book. And I didn't necessarily think if he could do it, I could do it. But it seemed a lot more possible, having read a book by someone I knew that worked. And I thought, you know, maybe I started looking back at these short stories, and I thought maybe there was a way to intersect them. And then I started coming up with different storylines. But I was working in a hotel one night, and the whole thing came to me working on that midnight shift of how this could work, how all these stories could intersect. So I rewrote all of the stories in novel form, and I guess the rest, as they say, is history.
Now, as I read The Suicide Game, I was struck by a few similarities between you and the writer character, Jeffrey. You're both from Kansas. You're both video store managers, writers. So where do you end and he begin?
Well, Jeffrey is even my middle name, so there's that. Jeffrey, by and large, is me. There are a lot of things that, you know, are not me. But, I mean, it could be said that I'm a part of every character in that book. You know, it sounds cliche, but it's true. You have to be able to find something in common with your characters. I've never been a gay phone sex operator, and I've never been a black hitman. But I have been a film writer, and I have managed a video store. You know, even little things like he talks about his two ex-lovers both left him for guys with the same name. And that actually happened to me. Both of my exes have a new husband that has the same name. You know, things like that I always find quirky, and I think they're so quirky that, you know, people wouldn't believe them, you know, if they saw them in fiction. But you always try to take those things from real life and put those into fiction. And
maybe it's just that I've got what, you know, the LA Weekly calls a hard-on for Quentin Tarantino, but I could swear that the Burt Edmonds character in The Suicide Game is a thinly veiled Tarantino. What do you have to say about that one?
Well, as a lot of people know, as you know, that's how we met. I worked for several years on the book on Quentin Tarantino. It was supposed to be my first book. I ran into some problems in writing it. Some of the problems were with Tarantino himself. I hit a point where he hadn't made a film in a couple of years, and this was only a three-year period. This was in between Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown, where I actually had a publisher tell me there's not much interest in him right now. Unless he dies or makes another movie, there's not going to be much interest in him. And that gave me the idea for the writer character to kill the filmmaker in order to create an interest for his book. Now, having said that, you know, the character isn't exactly Quentin Tarantino. He has some Tarantino-like qualities. I'll definitely give you that. But, you know, he's just basically supposed to be a despicable character. And if people happen to think that that reminds them a lot of Quentin Tarantino, then, you know, who am I to say otherwise?
Yeah, I just had to laugh, my good friend Sickle, because the line in the book where the Burt Edwards character asks a woman if he can masturbate while he sucks on her toes, it sounded right out of that posting from Bijoli Shah that came out over the summer.
Right. Well, that I can say it came directly from Quentin Tarantino. There's not a lot of, I would have a difficulty lying about that because it's so obvious, you know, let me masturbate while I suck your toes. That's, you know, pretty obvious quotation. but yes, that came from Quentin Tarantino. And again, it was one of those moments that I thought was so spectacularly weird that I just had to use it in fiction.
The other thing that I found kind of funny too, but in a totally different way, is that the structure of your novel, you know, it's so highly cinematic. You've got these really descriptive scenes and you're using the underworld milieu. It would actually lend itself to being adapted to the big screen by someone like Quentin Tarantino.
Well, I've got to say, you know, I've said this in some of my books and stuff. I'm a huge Quentin Tarantino fan, and a huge fan. And, you know, he basically made me want to be a film writer, and he basically inspired a lot of my writing. You know, I went through and I watched all of these films. I used to watch anything that came out, basically. And in 1994, when Pulp Fiction came out, it was this revelation to me. You know, what was happening on the screen just amazed me. And I took a lot of that away from that, and you know, a lot of elements from that have gone into my writing ever since. I've been writing about mob characters and this and that, and not to rip off or ape Tarantino, but inspired by Tarantino. You know, one of the things that always stood out in his work that I don't see in others' work is that there's this biracial underworld crime community. You know, and you don't necessarily see that in other works. I mean, instead you see something like in Goodfellas, where the Sam Jackson character is immediately shot in the head. But that was one of the things that always stood out to me. And he always had this zeal for really quirky, weird characters, or, you know, non-traditional characters. And so I hope that some of that has informed my work.
Well, yeah, I think it totally has. And just so folks know that, you know, I am definitely not saying that you are aping Tarantino in any way, because your characters are quirky, but they are unique. And it's nice to read these kind of characters that I didn't expect. And they just really kind of come off the page for me. And they've stuck with me, because I was very lucky to read an early draft of the book. And I think I read it back in February is when I finished it up. And, you know, a lot of these characters have stuck with me for all these months later. And, you know, I can recall them, recall their actions, recall their names, all these kind of things. So it's not like these kind of throwaway Truth or Consequences, New Mexico kind of, you know, QT ripoff kind of thing. So you have a very strong voice in your fiction. One of the things that I try to cover on the show is kind of the behind the scenes kind of thing. So can you tell me a little bit about the whole publishing process that you went through?
Okay, well, I sent the book out to a lot of publishers and I got a mixed bag of responses. The only person who absolutely hated it was an editor at St. Martin's Press. And I got that response on my birthday, which was a really shitty way to do my birthday. Most of the responses, by and large, were good, but they were things like, this is such an unusual book. It's so gritty in its depiction of drugs, in its depiction of sex, in its depiction of violence, that we're not sure there's an audience for this. Then last year, I entered a contest put on by a publisher out of Europe called Night Press. What it is they would take a section of your book and people would read them and they would vote for a month on them. And whoever wins would get a publishing deal. I actually came in second place in that contest, but it was the closest competition that they'd ever had. So both myself and the guy that beat me out both got published. So I then went through, you know, various editors, and the editing experience is fascinating because it's one of those things they don't really tell you about. You don't know how grueling it's going to be and how difficult it's going to be to totally dissect your book. But in the end, it helps so much. There's just nothing like a good editor.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's going to be one thing to put it down on the page and then another thing to have to think about it and think, why did I do this and why did I put that down? And for me, I know personally that sometimes it gets a little uncomfortable where it's like, well, I don't know why I put this down on the page. I don't want to talk about that.
Or I would hear a lot of these old adages, you know, like show it, don't tell it, and things like that, you know, where I'm using a passive voice and, you know, things that I had never thought about. So the editing experience has really changed the way that I write. The whole thing has just been amazing. It's gone by in a blur.
Other than the Herschel Gordon Lewis thing, what kind of stuff are you working on now? Are you doing any more fiction at the moment?
I actually have a novella coming out from Night Press in either January or February. It's tentatively titled A Time for Violence. Because I look at everything as it relates to film, I would say that it's sort of a combination between The Killing of a Chinese Bookie and Rolling Thunder or Man on Fire. It's basically a revenge story, and I'm pretty happy with that. At the moment, that's it. That's the only other project I've got coming out.
Yeah, I know you're a huge fan of Rolling Thunder, just so folks at home know that Andy wrote a great piece in the latest Cashiers to Cinemark, number 16, where you interviewed Haywood Gould, one of the screenwriters for Rolling Thunder, and that was just absolutely fascinating. I've got a lot of really good feedback about that piece.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
Well, yeah, it was very well written, and just he seems like such a character, and just some of the stories that he tells about the actual shooting of the film are just highly fascinating to me.
Yeah, I'm hoping to try to get a blurb from him for this novella, since, you know, Rolling Thunder is my favorite revenge story. You know, we'll see how that works out. You know, he might say, oh, your book sucks, I don't want to, you know. But he seems like such a nice guy that, you know, hopefully I'll be able to get some sort of blurb from him.
Fingers crossed. All right, so we're going to go ahead and take a little break here, and we'll play a clip from next week's show.
Electric Light in Blue. The story of Big John Wintergreen. A 5'4" motorcycle cop in a 6'2" world.
Did you know that me and Alan Ladd were exactly the same height? I hate that motorcycle they make me ride.
Come on, Johnny. Show them how you do it.
You see, you've been back only 6 weeks, and I'm going to do for you what it took somebody 6 months to do for me.
Yes, sir. What's that?
Nothing.
You're a joke, fella.
That's right. The officer in charge is talking to you, and he's saying that you're going to be arrested as an accessory after the fact in a murder case.
Electric Glide in Blue from United Artists. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
And we're back. That was a rare radio commercial for Electra Glide in Blue. You would not believe the hoops I had to jump through to get that one. So, Andy, I want to thank you again for coming out to the projection booth. And where should folks go to get their hands on The Suicide Game or any of your other books?
I always tell people the easiest way to get them is to go to Amazon.com. Pretty much everything is on there. Right now, The Suicide Game is available in Kindle format for just 99 cents. So please go out and buy it, get it, read it, enjoy it, hopefully. I hope everybody likes it.
All right, cool. Perfect gift for Christmas. So, and a fun game to play at home, too, The Suicide Game. So thanks again for listening. Be sure to check out more episodes of The Projection Booth on iTunes, via Stitcher, or on Jackalope Radio. And you can always get the lowdown on the website, which is projection-booth.com. And speaking of Christmas, there are plenty of good things to be had at some of our sponsor sites. So go onto the website, click on those ads over on the right-hand side, just click, and you'll get some excellent gifts for this holiday season.
I said to Eddie Bunker, I said, you know, I'd be one of those guys that would be, sodomized the first 2-3 days. I said, I'm a little guy, and I said, I don't even know how to make a fist. Eddie, I'm not a physical person. My sport was tennis.